He shrugged. Sometimes when she was supposed to be around, she was out of touch. I thought maybe her romance with Sam was going over the top, but when she'd tell me one thing about them, you didn't seem to know anything about it. And Sam's your partner, so you'd know, I figured.
So he'd called me to talk about Sam and Janilyn's wedding plans, at least in part to hear my reaction. Of course, I'd been completely shocked.
I saw her one time when she didn't see me. She was at a bar way across town, instead of at the Hair, and she was with the rogues I had turned down. I knew she was planning something. I'd had them all over at social evenings at the house, talked to them. The only one worth anything was Candace, and she wasn't sure she wanted to be in a pack, didn't like the power struggles. I got to respect that, but I thought she'd be an asset.
I thought maybe he'd also liked Candace's assets, but that was his business.
So I called up Candace, and I asked her to meet me alone. Without me even bringing it up, she volunteered to tell me what was going on, because it troubled her.
Alcide clearly wanted me to give Candace a virtual pat on the back, so I said, "She must be a good person." He smiled, gratified.
Candace said Janilyn wanted to challenge me, defeat me, but first she wanted to get a good toehold in the pack by socking away some money, enlisting pack members to her side, getting some of her own muscle. Her proposal to these rogues was that they could come into the pack if they do her bidding. Then when she beat me, she'd let them have full benefits.
I wondered if that included health and dental, but I wasn't going to go down a side path while he was still in a sharing mood. I hung up the washcloth and poured a dollop of shampoo into my hands. I began to scrub my scalp and hair. "Go on," I said, by way of encouragement.
"So," he said, "I got a guy she didn't know to follow Janilyn. He saw her meeting with your buddy Claude. There's just no good reason for that."
I stopped rinsing the shampoo from my hair. "What? Why? Why was she meeting with Claude, of all people?"
"I have no idea," Alcide said.
"So all we have to do is find Janilyn and ask her a lot of questions," I said, "and find Warren, and hope that Claude comes back from Ferry so I can question him, and get Felipe and his vamps to leave us alone here in Shreveport, and get that Freda out of here."
Alcide looked at me, wondered whether to speak, and decided on full disclosure. "Is it true, Sookie? Palomino told Roy that Eric's engaged to a vampire from Oklahoma?"
"I can't talk about it," I said, "or I'll get real upset, Alcide, and you just don't want that tonight. I owe Palomino a solid favor for getting us in to rescue a guy, but she shouldn't be telling vampire business around town."
"You owe her more of a solid than you know," he said. "She saw you being grabbed, and she called me, right before Bill did. That was smart, Sook, getting him to call. It was all I could do to get him to continue on his way and check back in later. I promised him I'd keep you safe."
"So you called Mustafa? You've known where he was all along?"
"No, but after I got your phone messages, I called him, as you'd advised, when Janilyn wasn't around. He'd run down his last lead on Warren, and he had to talk to someone. I still don't know where he's been hiding."
"But it's thanks to you that he found me in time."
"Both our efforts and some guessing, too. He knows those rogues. He figured they'd head back to their house outside Fillmore. Van does bad stuff to women, and he'd want to have some time with you before he handed you over to Janilyn. The follow-up car was his idea, too."
"Oh, my God."
I felt sick, wondered if I was going to throw up.
"No, I got hold of myself." After a little rinsing, I was as clean as I was going to get. Alcide left the bathroom so I could change into my more modest shorts and t-shirt. It was really interesting how much difference a few covered inches could make in your self-respect. Now that I felt more like myself, I could begin to think some more. I came out of the bathroom. Alcide was having a beer, and Mustafa was drinking a Coca-Cola. I accepted one, too, and the cold sweetness tasted wonderful going down. "So what are you going to do with the rogues for right now?" I asked.
"I'm going to stow them in a reinforced shed my dad built," Alcide said.
Jackson, his dad, had owned a farm outside Shreveport where the pack could run at the full moon. "So you have a special place to stow people," I said. "I'm sure Janilyn has a special place, too. You been thinking about where that might be?"
"Janilyn's from Shreveport," Alcide said. "So yeah, I've been thinking. She lives in the apartment above Hair of the Dog, so that's out. No place there. Besides, we'd have heard Warren if he'd been stashed there, or we'd have smelled him."
"If he was alive," I said, very quietly.
If he wasn't, definitely we'd have smelled him,
Alcide said, and Mustafa nodded, his face expressionless. So where does she have of her own, a place she could be fairly sure no one else would go?
Her mom and dad retired to Florida last year, Alcide said, but they sold their house. Our computer guy who works at the tax assessor's office couldn't find anything else in Janilyn's name.
You sure that house sold? In this market?
That's what she told me, and the sign was down last time I went by, Alcide said.
Mustafa stirred.
It's on a big lot, and it's pretty far out of Shreveport, he said. I was out that way once, driving with Janilyn, when the pack was courting me. She said she used to ride dirt bikes out there. They had horses, too.
Anyone can take down a sign, I said.
Alcide got a call just then and talked to the pack members who'd secured my abductors. They were on their way to Alcide's farm.
You don't have to be too civil,
Alcide said into the phone, and I could hear the laughter that came from the other end of the line.
I'd been struck by another thought, and as we went out to Alcide's car, I said, I guess grown up as a full-blooded ware in Shreveport, Janilyn would be pretty much bound to know all the others around her age. Even the kids who weren't full-blood.
Alcide and Mustafa shrugged, almost in unison.
We did, they said, and then smiled at each other, though their growing tension made that hard to do.
Kim Rowe was half-ware and not much older than Janilyn, I observed. Her folks came out to my house. Her dad's Oscar, a full-ware.
Mustafa stopped in his tracks, his head bowed.
Mustafa, was it Janilyn who made you let Kim into Eric's house?
Yeah,
he said, and Alcide stopped and turned to him. His face was hard and accusing. Mustafa said to both of us,
She told me she had warren. She told me I had to let this rogue girl into the house. That was all I had to do.
So it was her plan, I said carefully. Her plan, to get Eric to drink from this girl?
No, it was not her plan,
Mustafa said clearly.
She was hired to find a were-girl willing to carry it out, but it was the plan of this dude named Claude. I've seen him at your place. Your cousin?
Chapter 13. I was shocked. I was more than shocked. And the first coherent thought I had was, if Dermot was in on this, it'll break my heart. Or I'll break his neck. In our long drive through the night to Janilyn's parents' former place, I had more time than I needed to think, or maybe not enough. I was scrambling for some solid foothold, some sure thing. Why? I said out loud. Why?
I sure don't know, Mustafa said. The day I came to your house on the run, it was everything I could do to sit at the table with that Dermot and not try to choke it out of him.
Why didn't you?
Because I didn't know if he was in on it. That Dermot, he's always nice, and he seems to have a lot of love for you. I just couldn't see him stabbing you in the back like that, or taking Warren either, though I could see he might think that wasn't so bad, not knowing Warren, hardly knowing me.
I had to assume it had been Claude's blood that had made him so irresistible to Eric. Damn it, I said, and leaned forward to bury my face in my hands. I was glad to be sitting in the back seat where neither of them could see my face.
Sookie, we'll figure all this out,
Alcide said. He sounded very confident and strong.
We'll get this all taken care of. We'll clear Eric with the police.
From which I understood he was scared I'd start crying. I could sort of sympathize with that, and anyway, first things first, I was kind of beyond crying. I'd already shed enough tears. Glancing out the window, I saw we were now in a suburban area where the lots were at least 4 acres. Maybe this had been out in the country once upon a time, until Shreveport had grown.
It's right around here,
Mustafa said, and when we saw a white fence bordering the road, he said,
This is it. I remember the fence.
There was a horse gate across the driveway, and I hopped out to move it because I just wanted to get out of the car. They drove through, and I followed them. It was completely dark out here, no street lights. There was a security light in the front yard, but that was it. No lights on in the ranch-style house or in the freestanding garage a few feet behind it, where the driveway terminated. A dilapidated swing set rusted in the front yard. I pictured little Janilyn playing on it,
and found myself picturing a swing hitting her in the head. I grimly erased that image and joined the two men who'd gotten out of the car to stand uncertainly in the noisy night. The crickets and all the other myriad bugs of Louisiana were having a concert in the woods that bordered the property. I heard a dog bark far away.
"Now we break in," Alcide said, and I said,
"Wait."
"But,"
Mustafa began. "Be quiet," I said, finally feeling that there was something I could do rather than get swept into events as they passed me by. I sent out my other sense, the one that had shaped my life, the one given me at my birth by the demon Mr. Cataliades. I searched and searched, looking for the signature of a mind, and just when I was going to give up, I felt a faint flicker of thought. "There is someone," I said very quietly. "There is someone."
"Where?"
Mustafa asked eagerly. "In the attic over the garage," I said, and it was like I'd fired off the starting gun. Werewolves are creatures of action, after all. There were outside stairs on the side of the garage, which I hadn't seen. The sharper eyes of Alcide and Mustafa had, and up they swarmed. Mustafa, catching a scent he recognized, threw back his head and howled. It made my hair stand up. I moved to the foot of the steps, and though I still couldn't see much, I could make out the two figures on the landing above, beginning a furious motion. It accompanied a rhythmic thud. I realized the two men were throwing themselves against a door. There was a kabang that had to be the door flying back, and then a light came on. Mustafa howled again, and I feared that Warren was dead. I just couldn't stand it. The death of the little blonde sharpshooter with his pale freckled skin and his missing teeth was somehow more than I could bear tonight. I sank to my knees.
"Sookie,"
Alcide said urgently. I looked up. Mustafa was coming down the stairs, a body in his arms. Alcide was right in front of me.
"He's alive," Alcide said, "but he's been up there without air conditioning or ventilation or food or water for God knows how long. I guess the bitch couldn't be bothered. We gotta get him some help."
"Vampire blood?" I suggested, but very quietly.
"I think Mustafa might consider that now,"
Alcide said, and I knew that Warren must be very bad. I called Bill.
"Sookie, where are you?" he yelled. "I've been calling. What happened?"
I glanced at the screen. I did have a lot of missed calls. "I had the phone on vibrate," I said. "I'll tell you everything, but I want to ask you a favor first. Are you still in Shreveport?"
"Yes, I'm back outside the trifecta, trying to pick up the trail of those dogs."
"Hey, listen, chill. It's been a real bad night. I need you now, my friend."
"Anything."
"Meet me at Alcide's. You can save a life."
"I'm on my way."
On our way back into Shreveport, Mustafa took my place in the back seat with Warren's head on his lap. When I proposed that Bill give Warren a drink to help him live, Mustafa said,
"If it can bring him back, I'll do it. He may hate me later. Hell, I may hate myself, but we got to save him."
Our drive back into Alcide's neighborhood was shorter than our drive out because we knew our way now, but we grudged every stoplight or slow driver ahead of us, and Mustafa's urgency pounded at me. Warren's brain signature became weaker, flickered, resumed. Sure enough, Bill was standing waiting at Alcide's, and I leaped out of the car and pulled Bill around to the back seat. When the door opened and he saw Warren, recognition flared in his eyes. Of course, Bill knew Mustafa, and he remembered Warren, the shooter. I hoped it hadn't occurred to Bill that it might be a good thing if he died, since he was yet another witness who could testify, at least in a limited way, to what had happened the night we'd killed Victor. "He wasn't in the club," I said, grabbing Bill's wrist, as Mustafa gently lifted Warren's head so he could vacate the car to leave room for Bill. And Bill looked at me, a huge question on his face. "Feed him," I said. Without another word, Bill knelt by the car, bit his own wrist, and held the bleeding wrist over Warren's parched mouth. I don't know if Warren would have done it if he hadn't been so thirsty. At first, Bill's blood trickling into the slack mouth seemed to raise no reaction, but then something sparked in Warren, and he began to consciously drink. I could see his throat moving. "Enough," I said after a minute. I could sense Warren's brain firing back up. "Now, take him to the hospital, and they'll do all the right stuff for him."
"But they'll know."
Alcide was scowling at me, and so was Mustafa.
"They'll question him about who took him."
Bill, standing and holding his wrist, looked only mildly interested. "You don't want the police to arrest Janilyn?"
That seemed like the best of all possible worlds to me.
She'd kill them if they tried,
Alcide said, but I knew from the conflict flowing from his head that he wasn't voicing his real concern.
You want to punish her, I said, in as neutral a voice as I could manage.
Course he does,
Mustafa said.
She's Pack. She's his to punish.
I do want to ask her some questions, I said. It seemed like the right time to get that out in the open. Otherwise, Janilyn might end up dead before I'd had a chance to extract information.
What about Sam? Bill said, out of the blue.
What about him?
Alcide asked after a moment.
He's not going to be happy, I muttered. They weren't ever as close as she told you they were, but after all...
She's his woman,
Mustafa said, shrugging. He looked down at Warren. Just then, Warren's eyes fluttered open. He saw Mustafa and smiled.
I knew you'd find me, he said. I knew you'd come.
It was touching, it was awkward, and I was totally confused. So it was Claude, I said out loud. I just can't believe it. Why would he want Eric to drink from a borderline whore like Kim? Why would he give her his own blood to drink? I was beyond mincing words or being charitable.
Claude could tell you why,
Bill said grimly.
Where is he now?
Niall came to get him. I haven't seen Claude in days.
And he left Dermot here?
Yeah, he left Dermot in charge of all the stray soups at Hooligan's, I said.
I'd heard everyone there was some form of fae,
Bill said, confirming my belief that soups gossiped just like humans did.
Did Claude give you a time for his return?
No. Niall took him to Ferry to investigate who actually put a curse on Dermot. Claude said it was Murray, but Murray's dead. I killed him in my backyard. I sure had everyone's attention now. It seemed that all the separate parts of my life were finally colliding. My personal highway was jammed with fairies, werewolves, vampires, and humans.
So it was pretty convenient for Claude to name Murray as the bad guy,
Bill said, and that kind of hung in the air for a minute before everything came crashing down.
Claude,
I said.
It was Claude all along.
I felt numb. After a little while, we were all sorted out. Since no one knew where Janilyn was, Mustafa and Warren were invited to spend the night at Alcide's, and Mustafa accepted for them both, since Warren was still not talking much. Apparently, he wasn't going to go to the hospital, which I had to accept. At least he was getting a bottle of Gatorade. Mustafa let him have it in little sips. Bill and I got in his car, and Mustafa thanked Bill for coming to Warren's aid. He didn't like telling Bill he owed him a favor, but he did it. Alcide was already on the phone as we pulled out of the driveway, and I was sure he was checking on his pack members who'd locked up the rogues. I would put money on his main interest being Candace. I didn't know if she'd go into lockup with the rogues or if she'd abandon the pretense of being a rebel. At the moment, I could only be glad that wasn't my problem. I was glad Bill was driving. I had too many thoughts crowding my head. I wished there were a way to warn Niall what a snake he was nurturing in his bosom. And as long as I was getting biblical, I'd never in my life been so glad I'd said no to someone when they'd wanted to have sex with me.
Why would Claude have done such a thing?
I didn't realize I'd said it out loud until Bill answered.
Sookie, I don't know. I can't even guess. He doesn't hate Eric, or at least I can't think of any reason why he should. He might be envious you have such a handsome lover, but that's hardly sufficient reason.
I wasn't about to tell Bill that Claude had told me he occasionally bedded a real woman. Eric would surely have been more in Claude's natural ballpark. Okay, let's think, I said. Why would he try to make trouble in such a devious way? He could have set fire to my house, though that had already been done. He could try to shoot me, ditto. He could abduct me and torture me, likewise. If his goal was to make trouble for Eric, there were at least 20 more direct ways to cause it.
Yes, Bill said, but a direct way would have led straight back to him. It's the indirectness of it, the slyness of it, that convinces me that Claude wanted to stay in your good graces, stay close to you.
It's not out of love, I can tell you that.
Is there something I don't know about, Sookie? Some reason Claude would want your company? Want to live in your house and stay close to you?
After a moment of silence, Bill hurried to add, Not that any sane male wouldn't want to, even someone like Claude who likes other men.
Why, yes, Bill, I said. And it's funny you should bring that up. As a matter of fact, there is such a reason.
Though I clammed up then because I didn't need to spread the word any wider, I was fuming. I might as well get "I have a cluvial door" tattooed on my forehead. Thanks, Grandfather Fenton, for the great gift. And while I was at it, thanks, Sponsor Cataliades, for the telepathy. And also, while I was angry at people in my past, thanks, Gran, for A, having an affair with a fairy, and B, not using the cluvial door while you had the chance, and therefore sticking me with it. I had to talk myself down a little bit after that internal explosion of rage, all the more powerful because it was silent. I took a deep breath and let it out, as Bill had advised me to do earlier in the evening. The procedure did let off some steam and gave me the control necessary to clap some discipline onto my thoughts. One of the things I really like about Bill is that he didn't pester me with questions while I was working through all this. He just drove.
I can't talk about it now, I said. I'm sorry.
Can you tell me if you've heard from Niall or Claude since they left?
No, I haven't. I put a letter through, that is, I sent them a letter because Dermot's having a hard time controlling the remaining Fae. I'm sure you know they're getting restless.
They are not alone, Bill said darkly.
And you're referring to what?
I was too tired and upset to make any guesses. All our guests are still here. Felipe, Horst, Angie, he said. It's like having a visit from a king in the 18th century. You could be poor after such an honor. And they've bonded mightily with the stupid wrestler, T-Rex. Felipe even talks of asking him if he wants to be brought over. Felipe thinks he would make a popular spokesman for the pro-vampire movement.
Is Freda still here, too?
I was humiliated that I had to ask Bill to know the answer, but I wanted to know the answer so badly that I would accept the humiliation.
Yes. She's spending as much time with Eric as he'll permit her.
I didn't get the impression that she was in the habit of waiting for permission.
You're absolutely right. I can't decide if Eric is genuinely trying to discourage her or if he's driving up his price.
I felt like Bill had slapped me.
He said instantly,
"Sweetheart, I'm so sorry. I should have kept my mouth shut."
He sounded genuinely contrite, but I didn't trust anyone anymore.
You really think Eric's capable of that?
Sookie, you know Eric's capable of that. And much more.
Bill shrugged. I won't be less than honest with you, and I won't sugarcoat this situation. From my point of view, Eric's involvement with Freda is a wonderful thing, but for your sake, I hope Eric is so deeply devoted to you that he's determined to drive Freda to a more amenable mate.
He loves me.
I sounded like a terrified child telling her father that she really, really wasn't afraid of the dark. I despise that in myself.
Yes, he does.
Bill agreed readily. That conversation was clearly over, and it was one we wouldn't have again. I had a fantasy that when we got to my house, Eric would be sitting on the back steps waiting for me. He would have ditched all his Nevada company. He would be waiting to assure me that he had sent Freda packing, that he told her how much he loved me, that he never wanted to leave me no matter how much power and wealth she offered him. He would be shooting a final bird at his maker, Appius Livius Ocella. All the vampires in his sheriffdom would be happy about his decision because they liked me so much. As long as I was having a fantasy, I decided to build on it. In the daylight, Claude would return to my house with Niall. Niall would say that he had brainwashed Claude and that Claude was now an agreeable person who regretted any of his past deeds that had offended others. They both embraced Dermot as an equal and took him back to Faerie with them, along with all the other Fae at Hooligans. I could be sure they would be happy forever, since it was a fairy tale. Then I mentally married off Jason and Michelle and gave them three little boys. I married off Terry and Jimmy and gave their Catahoulas many litters. I named Alcide Packmaster for life and threw in a happy marriage to Candace and a resultant daughter. I gave the Durone twins full scholarships to Tulane, and for Sam, I simply couldn't think of the best gift for Sam. Of course, the bar would prosper, but with his tendency to fall for women on the supernatural side, well, the bar would prosper. Quinn would live happily ever after with his tigress, Tyherine,
and she would be able to rehabilitate the unpleasant Franny, who would become a nurse. I was probably skipping a few people. Oh yeah, Holly and Hoyt. They'd have a girl and a boy, and Holly's son by her first marriage would love his stepdad and his new siblings. Hoyt's lifelong friendship with my brother would never come between the couple again, because my brother would never drag Hoyt into trouble again. India would find some fine young woman, and the state of Louisiana would pass a bill to enable them to get married legally. No one would ever, ever make lesbian jokes or misquote scripture at them, as long as I was fantasizing. Bill, what's your favorite fantasy? I asked. Weirdly enough, I felt much better after designing all these happy endings. Bill glanced over at me quizzically. We were almost to my house.
My favorite fantasy? You come down into my daytime resting place stark naked, he said, and I could see the gleam of his teeth as he smiled. Oh, wait, Bill said. That's already happened.
There's gotta be more to it, I said. Then I could have bitten off my tongue.
Oh, there is.
His eyes told me exactly what happened after that. And that's your fantasy? That I come into your house naked and have sex with you?
After that, you tell me that you have sent Eric on his way, that you want to be mine forever, and that to share my life you will permit me to make you a vampire like me.
The silence now was thick, and the fun had drained out of the fantasy. Then Bill added,
You know what I'd say when you told me this? I tell you I would never do such a thing, because I love you.
And this, ladies and gentlemen, concluded our evening's entertainment. Chapter 14. When I woke up in my own bed, the sun was glaring outside. I did not have to work today. Getting to skip on your special day was a Merlot's rule. Last night had been an incredible night, all in all. I'd rescued two hostages, helped to get a bunch of bad rogue wares off the streets, and begun unraveling a conspiracy. Hard to top that. I'd also been kidnapped and bitterly disillusioned. I wanted to look good because my spirits were so low. When I was getting dressed to run errands and to go to an appointment I'd made days before, I put on my makeup and brushed my hair up into a ponytail that cascaded down from the crown of my head. While I was cleaning out my purse in the process of finding a pair of earrings, my hand closed around the colluvial door. I pulled it out and gazed down at it, the pale green soothing any anxiety I had about the day to come. I rubbed it between my hands and enjoyed the warmth and the smoothness. I wondered, for the 50th time, if I needed any special spell to activate its magic. On the whole, I figured not. My grandmother would have passed such a spell along to me, though as a staunch Christian, she disapproved of magic. But she wouldn't have neglected some element I might find necessary for my protection. I should put it back into my makeup drawer with the usual light camouflage. But I didn't. After a brief debate, I slid the round object into my skirt pocket. I understood, finally, that having it was no good if it was inaccessible. Leaving it in the drawer was equivalent to having an unloaded gun when burglars broke into your house. From now on, the colluvial door went where I went. If he decided to leave with Freda, would I use it? According to Mr. Cataliades, since I loved Eric, if I made a wish for him, it would be granted. I tried to picture myself saying, Eric must not choose to go with Freda. On the other hand, if he decided to go with the queen, he loved me less than he loved the possibilities in his future with her. Would I want to stay with someone on those terms? A lot of bad things could happen today, but I was going to keep my fingers crossed that they wouldn't. I just wanted one happy day. As I was getting up from the dressing table, I had second thoughts about leaving the colluvial door in my pocket. Was it really safe to carry such an irreplaceable object around with me? Apparently, all the Fae collected at Hooligans could tell there was something special about me, despite my minimal dash of fairy blood. That special thing must be my proximity to, or ownership of, the colluvial door. I shouldn't underestimate how much they'd want it if they knew I had it, not with their terrible desire to be back in the world they loved. I hesitated, pondered again, replacing it in the drawer. But then I thought, unloaded gun, and I popped it from my pocket into my purse, which latched shut and was therefore more secure. I heard a car pull up outside. I looked out the living room windows to see that my caller was Detective Cara Ambroselli. I shrugged. I wasn't going to let anything bother me today. She came in with a sidekick, a young guy whose name I couldn't remember. He had short brown hair, brown eyes, undistinguished clothes, and he wasn't tall or very thin or very muscular or very anything. Even his thoughts were fairly neutral. He was nuts about Ambroselli. That was something about him I could empathize with. And Ambroselli simply thought of him as her adjutant. "This is Jay Osborne," Detective Ambroselli said. "You're all dressed up today." "I have an appointment this morning," I said. "I can only give you a few minutes." I waved my hand at the couch, and I sat opposite them. Osborne was looking around the room, recognizing the age of the house, of its furnishings. Ambroselli was concentrating on me.
"T-Rex is quite a fan of yours," she said.
It was lucky I'd been warned ahead of time.
"That's pretty weird," I said. "I just met him the night Kim Rowe got killed, and I have a boyfriend, theoretically."
"He's called me to see if I'd give up your phone number." "I guess that says it all, that he doesn't have it," I shrugged. Then we went over the evening at Eric's again, from beginning to end. But just when I thought we'd wound up, Ambroselli decided to throw in one last question.
"Were you late that night because you wanted to make a big entrance?"
I blinked.
"Huh?
Coming in late to get T-Rex's attention?" She was asking questions at random. She didn't believe this. "If I'd wanted to get his attention, I guess I would have come earlier to spend as much time with him as I could," I said. "The ladies he was with were good-looking women, and I don't know why he'd be specially interested in me."
"Maybe your vampire boyfriend wanted T-Rex to be his friend. Couldn't hurt to have a popular guy like a wrestler on your side, in public opinion."
"I don't think I'm the strongest bribe Eric could come up with," I said. I laughed. Ambroselli was at an impasse in the case. She was hoping that by going from witness to witness and scattering half-truths and asking questions, she might stir up some fact that she could use. Though I could sort of sympathize with her, she was wasting my time.
"T-Rex hasn't called me, and I don't expect him to," I said after a moment. "If you'll excuse me, I have to leave myself."
Ambroselli and Osborne stood and slowly took their departure, trying to look as though they'd learned something significant. When I got to Bonton, I dropped by to pick up my dishes from Tara's house. The twins were asleep. Tara was slumped on the couch, almost dozing herself. I was glad I'd knocked very quietly. I think she would have thrown the pans at my head if I'd woken up Sarah and Rob.
"Where's JB?"
I whispered.
"He went to get some more diapers," she whispered back. "How's the breastfeeding going?"
"I feel like Elsie the cow," she said. "I don't know why I even buttoned my blouse."
"Is it hard to get them to nurse?"
"About as hard as getting a vampire to bite you," she said. I grinned. It was nice to hear that Tara could joke about something that had once made her crazy.
"By the way,"
Tara said as I turned to go, "is there something weird going on at Hooligan's?"
"What do you mean?"
I jerked around, very much on the alert. "Maybe that answers my question," she said. "That was quite a reaction, Sookie." I had no idea how to answer her. I said,
"Has JB had any trouble there?"
"No, he loves everybody on the strip team," she said. "We finally had a good talk about it. You know, and I know, that he loves to be admired, bless his heart. And there's a lot to admire about JB. I nodded. He was lovely. Not bright, never that, but lovely.
"But he thinks there's something wrong?"
"He has noticed some strange things," she said carefully. "None of the other guys could ever meet him for lunch, and they could never tell him what their day job was, and they seemed to pretty much live at the club." I didn't know what to tell her.
"I wonder how JB got hired," I said, to fill in until I could think of a good way to warn her off Hooligan's.
I was sure the Durones still needed extra money, though the twins had been able to leave the hospital at the regular time.
"How he got hired? He had heard about ladies only night from the women at the gym, and they all told him he was built well enough to perform,"
Tara said rather proudly. "So one day he went over to Hooligan's on his lunch hour."
One of the babies started fussing, and Tara darted into their tiny room to emerge with Sarah, or Robbie.
"If one starts crying, the other one will," she whispered.
She jiggled the baby gently, humming to the child. It was as if she'd been a mother for years instead of a few days. When the little head rested on her chest, she murmured, "Anyway, your cousin Claude said since J.B. helped you recover from your ordeal, did he mean your car wreck? That he'd give J.B. a job. Also," she met my eyes briefly, "remember I met Claude when I was pregnant? He was the one who told me I'd have twins that day in the park. He told J.B. he understood a father has to provide for his children." It hadn't been a car wreck I needed to recover from, but torture, of course. J.B. had helped me with physical therapy for weeks. I did remember telling Claude about that. Ha! Claude's kindness to J.B. was a good thing to hear, especially at this point in time, but I knew what my cousin really was, and I knew he was scheming some terrible thing. I left the little house after running a finger over the soft, soft baby cheek. "You're so lucky," I whispered to Tara. "I tell myself that every day," she said. "Every day." In my friend's head, I could see the kaleidoscope of miserable scenes that had composed her childhood. Her alcoholic parents, the parade of drug users through her home, her own determination to rise above the shack, rise above the degradation and squalor. This small, neat house, these beautiful babies, a sober husband, this was heaven to Tara. "Take care of yourself, Sookie," she said, looking at me with some anxiety. She hadn't been my friend this long for nothing. "You just watch out for those youngins. Don't you worry about me. I'm doing okay." I gave my friend the most convincing smile I could summon, and I let myself out of the house very quietly, easing the door shut. I went to the drive-thru at the bank to use the ATM, and then I drove to the newly opened law offices of Beth Osiecki and Jarell Hilburn. There were those who would argue that Bonton was overburdened with lawyers, but all of them seemed to be busy and thriving. And since Sid Matt Lancaster, who'd had a huge practice, had recently passed away, all his clients needed new representation. Why had I picked the new kids on the block? For that very reason. They were new, and I didn't know them, and they didn't know me. I wanted to start with a clean slate. I'd seen Hilburn before, from my transaction with Sam. Today I was seeing Osiecki, who specialized in estate planning. And since she was new, she'd agreed to see me on a Saturday. A girl barely out of her teens was sitting at the receptionist's desk in the tiny anteroom of the storefront office. Osiecki and Hilburn had rented the first floor of an old building right off the square. The electrical system would need overhauling, I was sure, but they'd painted and brought in good secondhand office furniture. Some potted plants made everything look a little nicer, and there wasn't any canned music playing, which was a huge plus. The girl, who didn't even have a name plaque, beamed at me and checked her appointment book, which had large white spaces.
"You must be Miss Stackhouse," she said.
"Yes, I have an appointment with Miss Osiecki," I sounded out the name.
"Osiecki,"
she said very quietly, presumably so the owner of the name wouldn't hear her correction. I nodded, to show I'd gotten it now.
"I'll see if she's ready,"
the girl said, leaping to her feet and making her way to the little corridor leading to the rest of the space. There was a door on the left and a door on the right, and after that, the area seemed to widen into a common space. I could glimpse a big table and a bookcase full of heavy books, the kind of books I would never pick up to read. I heard a brisk knock and a murmur, and then the teenager was back.
"Miss Osiecki will see you now," she said, with an expansive sweep of her hand.
I went back to talk to Miss Osiecki after taking a deep breath. A woman of about 30 stood up from her broad desk. She had well-cut, short, red-streaked brown hair, blue eyes, and brown glasses. She was wearing a nice white blouse and a wildly flowered skirt and high-heeled sandals. She was smiling. "I'm Beth Osiecki," she said, in case I'd gotten lost between the reception area and her office.
"Sookie Stackhouse," I said, shaking the outstretched hand.
She glanced down at the pad, and I could see she was going over the notes she'd scribbled the day before when I'd called her. She looked over at the big, scenic Louisiana poster by her desk.
"Well," she said, shooting me a quizzical look. It really is a special day for you, isn't it? It's your birthday, and you're going to make your will.
I felt a little strange after I left the lawyer's office. I guess there's nothing to make you think about your own demise like making your will. It's also a literally do-or-die moment. When your will is read, it will be the last time people will hear your voice, the last expression of your will and your wishes, the last statement from your heart. It had been a strangely revelatory hour. Beth Osiki was going to put everything in legalese, and I had to come in day after tomorrow and sign it. Just in case, I told her, I'd like to sign a list of the points I'd made. The list was in my own handwriting. I asked her if that would make it legal.
Sure, she'd said.
She'd smiled. I could tell that she was adding to her meager store of strange client stories, and that was okay with me. When I left Beth Osiki's office, I was pretty proud of myself. I'd made a will. I couldn't quite figure out what to do next. It was 3 p.m. I'd had a late breakfast, and a full lunch was out of the question. I didn't need to go to the library. I had several library books I hadn't read yet. I could go home and sunbathe, which was always a pleasant pastime, but then I'd sweat all over my good makeup and my clean hair. I was in danger of doing that now, standing here on the sidewalk. The sun was glaring down ferociously. I figured it was at least 100 degrees. My cell phone rang as I hesitated to touch the handle of my car door. Hello? I fished a tissue out of my purse and used it to cover my fingers as I opened the door. The heat rolled out.
Suki, how are you?
Quinn? I couldn't believe it. I'm so glad to hear from you.
Happy birthday, he said.
I could feel my lips curve up in an involuntary smile. You remembered, I said. Thanks. I was absurdly pleased. I hadn't exactly thought Tara would be thinking about my birthday, since she just brought twins home from the hospital, but maybe I'd been a tiny bit flattened when she hadn't mentioned it this morning.
Hey, a birthday is an important day,
the were-tiger said. I hadn't seen him since Sam's brother's wedding. It was good to hear his deep voice. How are you? I hesitated for a moment before adding, how's Tycherine? The last time I'd seen Quinn, he just met the beautiful and single and one of the last of her kind, were-tigress. I don't think I have to draw you a picture.
I'm going to be a father.
Wow. Way to go, I said. So you guys have moved in together? Where are you living?
That's not exactly the way we do it, Suki.
Okay. What's the tiger procedure?
Tiger men don't bring up their young, only the tiger mom.
Gosh, that seems kind of old-fashioned and kind of wrong.
To me, too. But Tig's real traditional. She says that when she has the baby, she'll go into hiding until he's weaned. Her mom told her that if it's a boy, I might see him as a threat.
I couldn't read Quinn's mind over the phone, but he sounded plenty exasperated and not a little resentful. As far as I knew, and I'd done a little reading on tigers when I was Quinn's girlfriend, only males who were not the actual dads were apt to kill tiger cubs. But since this was totally none of my business, I choked back the indignation I felt on Quinn's behalf. At least I tried to. So she'd used him to get pregnant with a were-tiger baby, and now she didn't want to see him anymore? I told myself sternly, not my battle. Werewolves were much more modern in their thinking, even were-panthers. Since my silence had lasted too long, I leaped in with both feet. Well, I'm so happy that you'll have a cub, since there aren't many of you all left. I guess your mama and your sister are excited?
Well, my mom is pretty sick. She brightened up a lot when I told her, but it was just temporary. She's back in that nursing home. Franny found a guy, and she took off with him last month. I'm not really sure where she is.
Quinn, that's so tough. I'm really sorry.
But I'm raining on your birthday, and I didn't mean to. I really did call to tell you to have a great day, Suki. No one deserves it more.
He hesitated, and I could tell there were more words that he wanted to say.
Maybe you could call me sometime,
he asked.
Tell me what you ended up doing to celebrate.
I tried to do some concentrated thinking in a very short time, but I just wasn't up to figuring out all the cracks and crevices in this tentative overture. Maybe, I said. I hope I do something worth talking about.
So far, all I've done is make my will. There was a long moment of silence.
You're kidding,
he said. You know I'm not.
There was a serious silence. You need me to come?
Oh, gosh, no, I said, putting a smile in my voice. I've got the house, the car, a little money saved up. It just seemed like time. I hoped I wasn't lying. Well, I gotta go, Quinn. I'm so glad you called. It made the day special for me.
I snapped the phone shut and dropped it into my purse. I got in the slightly less hot car and tried to think of somewhere fun to go, something fun to do. I'd picked up the newspaper and checked my mailbox on my way to town and hadn't pulled out anything but my auto insurance bill and a Walmart ad leaflet. I decided I was just hungry enough to treat myself to something special. I went to Dairy Queen and got an Oreo Blizzard. I ate it inside, since it was way too hot to sit in the car. I said hello to a couple of people and had a brief chat with India, who came in with one of her little nieces in tow. My cell phone rang again. Sam.
Sook, he said, can you come by the bar? We're short a case of Heineken and two of Michelob, and I need to know what happened.
He sounded pretty snappish. Damn. It's my day off.
Hey, you pretty much bought into the business. You gotta pull your share of the weight.
I mouthed a very bad word at the phone. Okay, I said, sounding just as irritated as I felt. I'm coming, but I'm not staying.
I strode through the employee entrance as if I were on my way into a bullfight ring. The hell, we were short three cases of beer.
Sam, I called. You in your office?
Yeah, come here, he called back. I think I found the problem.
I flung open his office door, and everybody in the world shrieked in my face.
Oh, my God, I said, shocked to the core.
After a throbbing moment, I understood that I was having a surprise birthday party. JB was there, and Terry and his girlfriend Jimmy, Sam, Hoyt and Holly, Jason and Michelle, Hallie Belfleur, Danny and Kennedy, even Jane Bodehouse.
Tara had to stay with the babies,
JB said, handing me a little package. Terry said,
we thought about giving you a puppy, but Jimmy said we'd better check with you first.
Jimmy winked at me over his shoulder. Sam held me so tight I thought I'd quit breathing, and I thumped him on his shoulder.
You creep, I said in his ear, missing cases of beer. I like that.
You should have heard your voice, he said, laughing. Janilyn said to tell you she was sorry she couldn't make it. She had to open at Hair of the Dog.
Sure, I believed she was really unhappy at not being here. I turned away so Sam wouldn't see my face. Hallie apologized for Andy's absence, too. He was on duty. Danny and Kennedy gave me a kind of group hug, and Jane Bodehouse gave me a highly alcoholic kiss on the cheek. Michelle held my hand for a moment and said, I hope you have a wonderful year this year. Will you be my bridesmaid? I grinned wide enough to split my face and told her I'd be proud to stand up with her. Jason wrapped one arm around me and handed me a beribboned box.
I didn't expect presents. I'm too old for a present party, I protested.
Never too old for presents, Sam said.
My eyes were so full of tears, I had a hard time unwrapping Jason's gift. He'd given me a bracelet my grandmother used to wear, a little gold chain with pearls set at intervals. I was shocked to see it.
Where was this?
I asked. I was cleaning the pie crust table I got out of the attic, and it was pushed way in the back of that shallow drawer, caught on a splinter, he said. All I could think of was Gran, and I knew you'd wear it. I let the tears run out then.
That's the sweetest thing, I said. The nicest thing you've ever done.
Here, said Jane, as eagerly as a child. She put a little gift bag in my hand.
I smiled and dug my hand in. Jane had given me 5 get-a-free-car-wash coupons from the place her son worked. I was able to thank her sincerely.
I'll use every one, I promised her.
Hoyt and Holly had gotten me a bottle of wine, Danny and Kennedy had gotten me an electric knife sharpener, and JB and Tara had re-gifted me with one of the 5 slow cookers they'd gotten when they got married. I was glad to get it. Sam handed me a heavy envelope.
You open that later,
he said gruffly. I gave him a narrow-eyed look.
All right, I said, if that's what you want.
Yeah, he said, it's what I want.
Hallie had made her version of Caroline Belfleur's chocolate cake, and I cut it so everyone could have a piece. Dairy Queen Blizzard be damned.
It was marvelous.
I think that's better than Miss Caroline's, I said, which was close to heresy and bon ton.
I put a pinch of cinnamon in, she whispered.
After the party, I went out the front to get birthday hugs from India, now on duty, and Danielle, who was working in my place. Hallie wanted me to come over to her house to see the nursery, which was completely ready for its expected occupant. I was so glad to be with a happy person who had no agenda. The visit was a real treat. After that, I had a quick supper with my grandmother's friend. Maxine, Hoyt's mom, had been a couple of decades younger than Gran, but they'd been tight. Maxine was so happy about Hoyt's wedding that I was feeling really cheerful after this visit. Plus, Maxine had told me some funny stories about Gran. It was nice to remember that side of Gran, the familiar side, instead of thinking of her affair with Fenton. Dang, that had knocked me for a loop. Thanks to Maxine, I had a nice hour remembering the Gran I'd always thought I knew. It grew dark as I drove home. Today was so much better than yesterday. I couldn't believe how lucky I was to have such good friends. The warm night seemed benevolent instead of scorching. I had a good time singing along with the radio, since there was no one to hear my awful voice. I'd hoped to at least get some phone messages from my vampire friends. Of course, I'd been hoping to hear from Eric most of all. But my cell phone didn't chirp on the drive back to my place. I stopped briefly at the end of the driveway to collect my local newspaper, and then I drove up to the house. It wasn't a total surprise, but it was a total relief to find that they were waiting for me. Pam's car was parked at the back of the house, and Bill, Eric, and Pam were sitting in lawn chairs in my backyard. Pam was wearing a low-cut flowered t-shirt and white cropped pants as a nod to the season, not that the temperature made any difference to her. Her high cork sandals were a great finishing touch.
Hi, y'all, I said,
gathering all my gifts up out of the back seat. I gave Pam a special nod to acknowledge her ensemble.
What's up at Fantasia?
We came to wish you a happy day, Eric said. And I suppose, as usual, Bill will want to express his undying love that surpasses my love, as he'll tell you, and Pam will want to say something sarcastic and nearly painful while reminding you that she loves you too.
Bill and Pam looked decidedly miffed at Eric's preemptive strike, but I wasn't going to let anything dim my mood.
And what about you, Eric? I asked on counterattack.
Are you going to tell me that you love me just as much as Bill, but in a practical way, while finding some way to subtly threaten me and simultaneously remind me that you may be leaving with Freda?
I bared my teeth at him in a ferocious smile as I trotted by the trio on my way up my back steps.
I unlocked the screen door, crossed the porch, unlocked the kitchen door, and went inside with my armful. After dumping the presents on the kitchen table, I stepped back out onto the porch and opened the screen door.
Any of you have anything new to say?
I looked from one to the other.
Or shall I just consider all this as said?
Pam was looking away to hide her grin.
Just that he was right,
Bill said, smiling openly.
I do love you more than Eric does. Have a great night, Sookie. Here's a gift for you.
He held out a little box with a bow on it, and I extended my arm to take it.
Thank you, Mr. Compton, I said, returning his smile, and he strode off into the woods.
At the edge, he turned to blow me a kiss. Pam said,
Sookie, I brought you something, too. I never thought I'd want to spend time with a human, but you're more tolerable than most. I hope no one hurts you on your birthday.
As birthday wishes went, that kind of sucked, but it was genuine Pam. I stepped down off the porch to give her a hug. She returned it, which made me smile. You never knew with Pam. Her touch was cold, and she smelled of vampire. I was very fond of her. She produced a small box, highly decorated, and pressed it into my hand. She stepped back and looked from me to Eric.
I'll leave you two to whatever talk you want to have, she said, her voice neutral.
Eric was her maker, and there was a limit to the verbal abuse she could deal out. In a moment, she was gone.
Won't you give me a hug, too?
Eric looked down at me, one eyebrow hiked up.
Before I start giving out hugs to you, I need to know what our situation is, I said.
I sat down on the back steps, setting my presents carefully to the side. Eric sat down, too.
I wasn't happy anymore, of course, but I was much calmer than I'd thought I'd be when I'd realized we had to have this conversation. "I think you owe it to me to level with me," I began. "For weeks, it seems like we haven't really been a couple, though you still tell everyone I'm your wife. Lately, that's just meant we have sex. I know it's a tradition that guys don't like relationship talks. I don't think I do either, but we have to have one."
"Let's go inside."
"No, that might end up with us in bed. Before we do that again, we need to have an understanding between us."
"I love you."
The security light glinted off his blonde hair and was swallowed in his all-black getup. He dressed for a funeral tonight. "I love you too, Eric, but that's not what we're talking about, is it?" Eric looked away.
"I think not,"
he said reluctantly.
"Sookie, it's not just a straightforward decision, you over Freda. If it were only one woman over another, it's you I love. That's a given, not a choice at all. But it's not that simple."
"It's not that simple," I repeated. I felt too many things to select one emotion, to say that's the way I feel. I'm in dread, or I'm angry, or I'm numb with fear. I had all those feelings, and more. Since I couldn't bear to look at Eric's face any more than he could bear to look at mine, I looked up at the starlit sky. After another moment's silence, I said, "But it is, isn't it? That simple." The night swelled with magic. Not the beneficent kind of love magic that sweeps couples away, but the kind of magic that rips and tears, the enchantment that creeps out of the woods and pounces.
"My maker gave this to me as his last order," Eric said.
"I would never have believed you'd try this argument," I said. "I'm just obeying orders? Come on! You can't hide behind Appius's wishes, Eric. He's gone."
"He signed a contract, and it's legally binding," Eric said, still keeping his composure.
"You're giving yourself an excuse for doing something painful and wrong," I said.
"I'm locked into it," he said, his expression savage.
I looked down at my feet for a minute. I was wearing my happy sandals again, high-heeled and with little flowers on the strap across my toes. They looked ridiculously frivolous, appropriate for a single woman's 28th birthday. They weren't kiss-your-lover-goodbye shoes. "Eric, you're a strong vampire," I said. I took his cool hand. "You've always been the boldest, baddest guy around. If your maker were alive, I'd believe you couldn't help this. But I watched Appius die, right here in my yard. So here's my bottom line. Here's what I really believe. I think you could get out of this if you hated Freda. But you don't. She's beautiful, she's rich, she's powerful. She needs you to watch her back, and the reward will be lots of the stuff you love." I took a deep, shuddering breath. "All I got is me, and I guess that's not enough." I waited, praying to hear a rebuttal. I looked up at him. I saw no shame. I saw no weakness. I saw instead a laser-like intensity in his blue eyes, so like my own. He said,
"Sookie, if I turn down this opportunity, Felipe will punish both of us. Our lives will not be worth living."
"Then we'll leave," I said quietly. "We'll go somewhere else. You'll work for some other king or queen. I'll find a job." But even as I spoke the words, I knew he would not opt for this. In fact, I found myself wondering if I would have said it if I'd believed there was any chance he'd say yes. On the whole, I thought I would, though it would have meant leaving everything I found dear.
"If only there were some way to prevent this," Eric said. "But I don't know of any way, and I can't tear you away from your life."
I didn't know whether my heart was ripped in two, whether I felt anguish or relief that I'd been sure he'd say that. But he didn't say anything else. He was waiting for me to speak. The apprehension was so strong in me that I felt my eyebrows draw together in a question. "What?" I asked. "What?" I couldn't imagine where he wanted me to go in this terrible conversation. Eric seemed almost angry, as if I weren't picking up my cue. I continued to be bewildered. He continued to try to force some statement from me. When he was sure I genuinely didn't have a clue, Eric said,
You could stop this if you chose.
Each word came clear and distinct.
How?
I dropped his hands, spread my own to show my ignorance.
Tell me how?
I rummaged through my mind as fast as I could, trying frantically to understand what Eric could mean.
You say you love me, he said angrily. You could stop this.
He turned to walk away.
Just tell me how,
I asked, hearing and hating the desperation in my voice.
God damn it, just tell me how!
He cast a look over his shoulder. I hadn't seen that expression on his face since we'd met, when he'd regarded me as just another disposable human. And then he was in the air. And then he was lost in the night sky. I stood staring up for a minute or two. Maybe I expected blazing letters to appear in the sky to explain his words. Maybe I thought Bill would pop out of the woods like a deus ex machina to tell me what Eric had been so sure I would understand. I went back into the house and automatically locked the door behind me. I stood in the middle of the kitchen, cudgeling my tired brain into activity.
Okay, I said, let's figure this out. Eric said I could stop him from leaving with Freda. But it can't be just that I love him, because I told him that, and he knows it, I whispered. So it's not how I feel. It's some act I need to perform.
What act? How could I prevent their marriage? I could kill Freda, but not only would that be a horrible thing to do, since she'd done nothing more than desire the man I loved, but any attempt to kill the powerful vampire would be simply suicidal. And killing Eric would hardly produce a happy ending, and that was the only other way I could imagine stopping him. I guess I could go to Felipe and beg him to keep Eric, I thought. Though Eric had said Felipe would punish both of us if Eric remained in Louisiana, disobliging Freda, I seriously considered how I would go about appealing to the king. What response would he have? He knew I'd saved his life once upon a time, but though he'd made me big promises, he hadn't exactly come through with them. No, Felipe would laugh when I went down on my knees, and then he'd tell me he thought he ought to honor Appius's wishes and let Appius's child make such an advantageous match. In return, I was sure Felipe would be favored in any subsequent dealings between Oklahoma and Nevada or Arkansas or Louisiana. All in all, I really couldn't see any chance at all that Felipe would agree to let Eric remain in Shreveport. Eric's worth as a sheriff couldn't equal the huge plus of having him at Freda's side, murmuring things into Freda's ear. Okay, begging Felipe was out. I can't say I wasn't relieved. I was still poking at my brain, trying to get it to spit out an idea, while I showered and put on my nightshirt. Eric had been so sure I could stop the Freda-Felipe deal. How? It was like Eric thought I had a magic wish, something tucked up my sleeve. Oh. I froze, one arm through an armhole, the rest of the nightshirt bunched around my neck. I didn't breathe for a long moment. Eric knew about the Cluvial door.